you know, many LGBT people left their churches, were kicked out of their churches, felt discriminated and harassed by their churches, denied rights by their churches. So it's just, you can understand how many people in the LGBT community were really angry at the Christian church. And so I've always felt that part of the role of Metropolitan Community Churches, the church that I pastored in Toronto, that part of our role was to re-spiritualize the community, you know, to say to people, you don't have to give up on God because of what the church has done. You can reclaim your spirituality and you can find a faith home where you're not going to be condemned.
Welcome to the podcast Queer Devotions from Rainbow Faith and Freedom. I'm Bridget Palufry. On the show, I talk to people about what it means to navigate the world as a member of the 2S LGBTQ plus community and a member of a faith or spiritual tradition. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Brent Hawks, founder and executive director of RFF. This is a conversation that works through decades and decades of activism, including his hunger strike protesting the bathhouse raids in Toronto, and his role in officiating the first ever legal same-sex marriage in the world. I learned a lot from this conversation, and I hope you enjoy it too. Welcome to the podcast today, Brent. How are you doing today?
I'm great, thank you.
So I just wanted to start with your beginnings. You were raised as a fundamentalist Baptist, but not by your parents. Could you describe what faith meant to you in your childhood and as you came of age?
Sure. Because my parents both worked every day of the year except Christmas Day, the church became my second family. I started attending when I was 3 years old, and so I grew up in the church. And so it wasn't just a Sunday experience, but there was young people's group, and there was summer camp and Bible study and all kinds of activities. So the church became my spiritual home, obviously, but also became, as I said, my second family, a place where I had lots of friends and really contributed and learned a lot, grew a lot. So the church became very, very important to me all of my growing up years.
And then as you moved sort of towards adolescence, how did that experience of finding community in the church change?
Yeah, it changed because as I, you know, increasingly discovered that I was gay, and in those days, I didn't have any words to describe it. I didn't know anyone else was gay. I thought I was the only person in the world this way. There was nothing on TV. There were no groups or organizations or community leaders. And so it was something I just kept very quiet to myself. But gradually began to learn what the church thought about this. But that was a little later on. I remember a very early experience that you know, was so profound. There was a bunch of guys playing basketball one day, and as they were playing, they were making jokes about homosexuals. And so at the end of it, one guy was by himself practicing, and I asked him, I said, "What's a homosexual?" And he said, "Go look it up in the dictionary," and told me how to spell it. And I remember going home and looking up the dictionary, and it was something like, you know, two men who are attracted to each other, or two women who are attracted to each other, something like that. So the next day they were playing basketball again, and afterwards he was practicing again. And so he said to me, "So did you look it up?" And I said, "Yes, it's about, you know, two men who are attracted to each other." And I said, "I think that's me." And I remember him picking me up and setting me on a fence post and saying to me, "That's dirty and that's evil. Don't you ever tell anyone." So, you know, I began to learn what other people thought about this attraction. I began to learn, you know, more and more what my church thought about homosexuality. And it was very difficult because you can imagine if you believe this is something you can't tell your family, if you believe this is something that your church and God condemns, you know, I prayed and prayed and prayed that it would go away. And it never did. And it was really difficult. But the one saving grace, ironically, was, you know, being raised in a strict fundamentalist tradition, my church was wrong about so many things, you know, and my, you know, half of my family were Roman Catholic, and yet they taught that it was wrong to hang around with Roman Catholics, that they weren't Christians. Right. And so eventually in my later adolescent years, and I began to learn that the church was wrong about this, just like they were wrong about so many things. But that didn't change the fact that I knew what people thought about it. And so I never came out to my family, never came out to anyone else, and talked about it. And it was very lonely, very difficult time.
And so you had initially felt called to the ministry and decided not to go that path. You went to teacher's college. And so what was that experience like when you were a teacher and felt disconnected how did you feel towards your faith or spirituality at that time?
Sure. So I'm going to back up a little bit and go back to junior high school when I felt called to ministry. And I really wrestled with that because I felt it was God's call. This is what God wanted me to do. But I knew I couldn't be a Baptist minister and be gay. I knew that would not work out. And so when it came time to decide what I was going to do after high school, where I was going to apply, I decided instead of going to Acadia University and become a Baptist minister, I decided to go to Mount Allison University and become a high school teacher, become a teacher eventually. But that was really difficult because I felt like I was abandoning my best friend because I never felt that God and I had a problem. I felt the church and I had a problem. And so ended up going to Mount Allison University, and I got a Bachelor of Science degree, a Bachelor of Education degree, so I could teach. And my time at university was also challenging because, again, I didn't talk to anyone about it. I certainly heard it talked about more in conversations. Mostly derogatory or in a negative way. At university it was difficult because, all of my friends were hanging out and, all the guys had girlfriends and all the girls had boyfriends. And I just wished I could be in that situation, but I did not want to use a woman. I did not want to hide behind a date. And so it was a lonely time. And later on, a bunch of my friends said they thought I was gay, but they couldn't understand why I didn't trust them, why I didn't tell them. But again, it was lonely. But at university, after my first year at university, I faithfully went to the local Baptist church. But after that first year, I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't handle a number of the things that the church was saying, but particularly what the church was saying about homosexuality. So I stopped going to church, and that became a difficult time for me because, I felt like I had to choose between my sexuality and my spirituality. And so I, had a wilderness period, I call it, when the last 4 years of university and the 3 years that I was teaching, I didn't attend church at all. And that was difficult because the Christian church, and I think most faith communities at their best, provide comfort in times of difficulty, challenge you to be more loving and forgiving and more open. And there's a real sense of community. And I missed that. I missed that spirituality and that sense of community. Then, I taught high school. And while I was teaching high school, I found out that there was a gay bar in Halifax. And so I went in. And the very first time I went into the gay club, there was someone there who I went to university with, Harold. And he eventually introduced me to lots of other gay people. He showed me around town. He took me to a bookstore, an adult bookstore that had one shelf of gay stuff around the corner, kind of hidden. And I remember that day buying one copy of everything. And I distinctly remember sitting out in front of the bookstore by myself in my 1972 Ford Pinto car, looking through a copy of The Advocate, which is the national LGBT magazine in the United States. And as I was looking through it, frankly, looking at the pictures, I saw an ad with a cross. And it was an ad out of Los Angeles for Metropolitan Community Churches. And I sat there and I cried because I knew it was home. I knew it was where I could find community again, where I could answer my call to ministry. And it was an amazing feeling to realize that there were LGBT faith communities out there where I could be welcome. And so eventually I wrote the head office in Los Angeles. And they told me about the church in Toronto. That was the nearest one. So I contacted the church in Toronto and eventually got a weekend when I didn't have any commitments. And I flew to Toronto to meet the pastor of the church. And he said to me something that really, really struck me. He said, "Brent, you need to move to Toronto and find your people." And so I eventually handed out my resignation to retire at the end of my third year of teaching, and planned to move to Toronto. But one of the big things then was, what do I say to my parents? Because I didn't want my family to see me in the news and demonstration or something and find out that I was gay. So I wrote my parents a letter, and I tore it up. And I wrote it again and tore it up. I don't know how many times until I just had to send the letter. So finally, I mailed the letter, and my parents did not take it well. They were really upset, some awful things were said by my dad about me being gay. So it was a rough few months. My parents stopped calling me after that. My mother used to mail me a letter every week, telling me what's happening with my younger brothers and sisters and the neighbors and relatives. Those all stopped. And it was really, really difficult. And then finally my parents called and said, Brent, we miss you. We want you to come home. You know, if you want to bring friends, that's okay. And that began a real healing journey with my mom and dad and the rest of my siblings. And ultimately they were very, very, very supportive. And I'm very blessed to have when my mom and dad were alive and the support. So I moved to Toronto in 1976 and became the pastor in 1977. And I was there a little over 40 years.
So the experience of moving to Toronto, you were coming into, for your first time, the inclusive faith community you had always dreamt of or longed for. What was that experience like, coming into both a gay liberation movement in Toronto at that time period, and then also this inclusive faith community almost simultaneously? How did those two experiences work together?
Yeah, and the other piece, the third piece of that shift, was just living in a big city, right? I remember my first couple of weeks here, I kept thinking, why are these groups of people standing around in street corners like this? Until I realized they were bus stops. People were waiting for buses. So it was very strange. I remember packing up my car and everything I owned into my car and driving to Toronto and I was supposed to arrive on August the 1st, but the car broke down on the way and I had to get that fixed. And then I arrived on August the 2nd, 1976. And I remember the first church service was really amazing, just to sit there in church and to sing some of the hymns that I were used to singing when I was in my Baptist church and reading some scripture and sermons. But, the sense of community, the sense of, everyone being so excited to be there and so grateful to have this safe place to be able to bring our spirituality and our sexuality back together again was quite amazing. So I knew it was home, from the very beginning. And so I eventually found a place to live in Toronto and got a secular job working for an insurance company to pay the bills. And was made a student clergy at the time and did the training I needed to so that August of 1977, I was ordained and I became the pastor of the church. And August the 24th, 1977. So moving to Toronto was phenomenal in terms of living in a big city. It was exciting to be going to not just the one bar in town, but there were and in those days, the bars were the only social place. They were the place where you hung out. They were the place where you made friends. They were the places where you cruised, et cetera. And so they were the safe place. And so it was fun being engaged in that. I very quickly got involved in LGBT politics. In those days, we'd say gay politics. Became the church's representative the fall of 1976, there was a national gay conference at Jarvis Collegiate and brought gay groups from all over Canada together. And I was at that conference representing the church. So it was pretty amazing, in those days that the movement was very small. You got quickly to know a lot of the leaders of the various organizations. It was quite a journey in terms of changes. The Toronto and the church and the gay community. And it was pre-AIDS. So it was full of talk about liberation and pushing the boundaries. But it was also a time when there was no human rights protections. We were just newly decriminalized because up until 1969, it was a legal penalty. You could be sent to jail for being involved in any same-sex sexual activity. And people were. and there was no human rights protection, so you could be fired from your job, and people were. You could be kicked out of your apartment if they found out you were gay. You were denied access to hospitals, to intensive care if your partner was sick because you weren't viewed as family. And so you could be denied service in a restaurant, you know, or a taxi, you know, and people were. All of them. People today don't realize how difficult it was, and how people had to protect their identity. And, you know, it was before my time, but I've even told the story of one of the bars. It was called Letros, and it was a dance bar. And there'd be lots of male couples and female couples dancing. And whenever the police came to raid or to visit, the bouncer would flick the light and everyone would change partners and grab a partner of the opposite sex so that they wouldn't be arrested.
Wow.
And stuff. So it was, you know, it was a very, very difficult time when you were, you know, you're viewed as a criminal by the justice system and by the political system, when you're viewed as sick by the medical system. It was really difficult. And what we need to remember now, a lot of that has changed in Canada and some other countries, but there's still over 70 countries in the world where you have absolutely no protections and where you could be arrested for any same-sex sexual activity or even the hint of it, and where you can still be fired from your job. I mean, just with just a very recent that even in the United States, people got protection for their employment. And so an employer couldn't fire you if they thought you were gay. But in many countries of the world, that's still the situation. And in, I think it's about 8 of those countries, LGBT people are executed if they're found out to be gay or lesbian. And the murder rate of trans people around the world is unbelievable. And so, you know, it thinking back into the late 70s, you know, there's, you know, glimpses back then of what people experience and live through today. So we have to be mindful that, yes, we've come a long way, but there's still a lot more that needs to be done in Canada and around the world. So, you know, it was scary in those days. You couldn't trust the police. You know, we used to, after demonstrations, we used to say to people, leave in a group because you don't want to be beaten up by the skinheads and the gay bashers, or you don't want to be beaten up by the police. And so there were a lot of challenges, no question.
And speaking about the police, you went on a hunger strike for 25 days after the police brutalized members of gay bathhouses in Toronto in 1981. So for those first who aren't familiar with the bathhouse raids, because, you know, some of us are newer to this, could you first just explain what the bathhouse raids were?
Sure. What that experience, you know, was like. I mentioned before that the bars were kind of the central socializing space for the gay community. There weren't any, you know, sports groups or all kinds of other places for people to meet people, to make friends, et cetera. So the bars were predominantly the places where that was done. But there were also the bathhouses. And, you know, historically in many parts of the world, you know, bathhouses that typically are male only become places for gay people to meet each other. And in some cases, when those bathhouses become gay bathhouses, then those are places where sexual activity is safe. And so people don't have to risk sexual activity in places where they might be discovered or arrested or beaten up. They can go to a bathhouse and socialize, meet people, make friends, and have sex if they want. And so they become a very much important part of the gay scene. And in Toronto, we had a number of gay baths. And occasionally the police would, you know, harass one of them or, you know, arrest somebody in one of them. But in the first couple of months of 1981, the police raided a number of the gay bathhouses in Toronto, and they arrested over 300 people in one night. And it became the largest arrest in Canadian history other than the War Measures Act in Quebec. Mm-hmm. And they not just arrested people. I mean, if they wanted to challenge the gay baths, they could have arrested one owner and one client. But they didn't. They raided them. They tore the baths apart. They terrorized the people that were in them. In one of the bathhouses, the Richmond Street bathhouse, they lined the gay men up in the shower area. And one of the officers said, "I wish those showers were hooked up to gas instead of water." And one of the young men, his parents had gone through the Holocaust. Mm. Right? And so it was an awful thing. The police so overreacted in many, many ways. And the media were phenomenal. They covered it. They showed the bathhouses being torn apart. They covered some of the stories of people of how they were treated and how terrified people were about being found out and losing their jobs or being outed to their friends. And typically in those days, when someone's name was published in the paper, where they were arrested for something or accused of being gay, suicide became an option for people. And so people were afraid that people were going to commit suicide or die by suicide. And so it was very scary, and it really enraged the gay community. And so there were a lot of demonstrations, a lot of protests, and it became more and more violent. The police were beating up gay people around the demonstrations. Gay people were setting fire to garbage cans and trying to roll over police cars. And I was really concerned about the increasing violence, particularly on behalf of the police. And so I felt led, called to go on a hunger strike to protest the police activity and demand an investigation. So I went on a hunger strike for 25 days. Then the city council on the 25th day passed a motion to set up an investigation. And so they hired an investigator, a human rights journalist named Arnold Bruner. And he interviewed me, a lot of the leaders in the gay community. He interviewed the police and ultimately came out with the Bruner Report, which basically made a lot of recommendations for improving the relationship. And it took us about 25 years to get them all implemented. But gradually that began to change the relationship between the police and the broader LGBT community.
Wow. So you describe, I mean, your faith was a big part of what called you to that moment. How could you describe that a bit more?
Sure. Hunger strikes are a civil disobedience tool that's used a lot in civil rights movements. And sometimes it's the only way to mobilize opposition to a certain government policy and to get action. And it was getting really violent. And I was afraid where that was going to go. It just, you know, I felt God's call to do that. And, thankfully ended with an investigation that was ultimately very, very helpful in terms of the relationship with the police.
So thank you for taking us through that. What an intense moment in history, and one that we can see reflected around us in 2020 as well.
Yeah.
And I am curious, so you described in another interview that many in the gay liberation movement, or, you know, folks in the LGBTQ community were quite anti-religious, quite skeptical. And so what was that process like as you had become a pastor? What was that process like sort of reaching out to that community again and trying to make people feel comfortable or included and to sort of change the narrative around religion?
Sure. So I think many LGBT people are deeply, deeply spiritual. I think part of it is because of our sense of differentness. You know, in the Canadian Aboriginal community, the gay lesbian people are called two-spirited, that they have both the male and female spirit within them. And in many cultures, we're known as shamans and spiritual people. So there's a depth of spirituality that's there. But because of the sins of the church, because of the homophobia and transphobia from many, many faith communities, not just Christianity, but many faith communities. And that arises, frankly, because we're relying on documents to guide us that were written thousands of years ago that, frankly, didn't understand the issue, didn't understand what homosexuality is about, didn't understand the difference between homosexuality and pedophilia, for instance. And so a lot of those ancient documents are not as helpful, I'm going to put it mildly, around sexuality issues and particularly homosexuality issues. And so so the Christian church has been one of the leading supporters of homophobia and transphobia around the world. Many times when gay rights are being debated, it's the Christian church and other faiths as well that oppose any progress. But we also see it around racism. I mean, the Christian church used some obscure scripture to support apartheid. I mean, if you can believe that, in South Africa and in the southern part of the U.S., frankly, and using, like I said, you know, it says slave, obey your master. They ignore the one that says there's neither slave nor free. We're all one. And so you can pick and choose scriptures to support and to condemn almost anything. And the Christian church has done that. So, you know, many LGBT people left their churches, were kicked out of their churches, felt discriminated and harassed by their churches, denied rights by their churches. So it's just, you can understand how many people in the LGBT community were really angry at the Christian church. And so I've always felt that part of the role of Metropolitan Community Churches, the church that I pastored in Toronto, that part of our role was to re-spiritualize the community, you know, to say to people, you don't have to give up on God because of what the church has done, that you can reclaim your spirituality and you can find a faith home where you're not going to be condemned. And so I think it's really important to remember that religion is not the problem. But religious-based discrimination, religious-based homophobia, religious-based transphobia, that's the problem. And so we have to call, you know, our faith communities to change and to be different and to be more inclusive. And in the case of the Christian church, to be more Christ-like. And so it was a challenge, you know, because, you know, someone once said to me that it's easier to come out as gay in the Christian community than it is to come out as Christian in the gay community. And I think that was true at one point. Mm-hmm. And people would see me as selling out to the enemy by being a pastor of a Christian church, even though it was an inclusive and progressive church. But once they saw our church becoming more involved, once they saw me at demonstrations and speaking at demonstrations and helping to organize for change, people began to gradually trust again. And I'm, you know, very pleased to see that Metropolitan Community Churches around the world have generally led the way. And they might be the only place in town that's safe initially, but ultimately we've seen in many countries around the world now more and more faith communities being open and accepting.
Hmm. And talking about ways that you try to signal to folks in the LGBTQ community that religion could be a place or spirituality could be a place of inclusion, you officiated the first ever legal same-sex marriage in Canada. So talk about messaging in that moment. So how did the church become such a tool of justice? And what did you sort of see as you officiated that marriage in terms of how people began to view churches or other religious organizations in the fight towards justice?
Sure. So our church, you know, has been very, very involved in the fight to change the Human Rights Code, played a leadership role in getting the Human Rights Code changed in Ontario so that people weren't fired from their jobs. Led the fight for relationship recognition so we could visit hospitals when our partners are sick, et cetera. So we played a leadership role. And in terms of equal marriage, in fact, technically it was the first legal same-sex wedding in the world, not just in Canada.
Oh, not just Canada, the whole world.
Yep. Now, there are ancient times we got married and stuff, but in terms of modern history and in the system of legislation and courts and stuff. Mm-hmm. What happened was, in that particular case, there were eight couples who tried to get a license from City Hall to get married, but they were denied the license. And the city said, you know, we would like to give it to you, but we can't because of the provincial law and the federal law. Because marriage is covered, the cities or municipalities issue the license, the province decides who can do the weddings, and the federal government decides who can get married. So everyone has their hand in this a little bit. And so those couples sued the city, sued the province, and sued the federal government for the right to get married. And while their cases were in the courts, our church intervened with our lawyer on their behalf. And so our lawyer was meeting with their lawyers and planning strategies, et cetera. And while that was happening, a professor from Queen's University, Professor Kathleen Leahy, had done some research. And she found that in Ontario and in some of the other provinces, not all, in some of the other provinces, there's two ways to get married. You can do the route that these eight couples did by going to City Hall and getting a license, and then you find a rabbi or a pastor to officiate at the wedding, or a justice of the peace. A variety of people can do the weddings. And so it's the combination of getting the license and then having the ceremony to sign the license. And so, but Kathleen Leahy discovered that in Ontario, there was a second way to get married, an older way, and ironically, a more churchy way. And it's called the reading of the banns, B-A-N-N-S. And that's where you start out by going to a pastor and you say, would you marry us? And if the pastor says yes, then the pastor issues a license on behalf of the state and officiates at the ceremony. And in that section of the Marriage Act, it said any two persons. It never said male and female. And so when Kathleen discovered that, she said, hey, Brent, I think you can do marriages now, because I had a wedding license to do heterosexual marriages. So we announced in January of 2000 that in January the 14th, 2001, we were going to perform a marriage of a gay male couple and a lesbian couple. And we did. There were death threats. There were 50 police officers in the church protecting the church and searching everybody that came in because of the death threats. I had to wear a bulletproof vest. There were protesters outside. But the wedding proceeded. The weddings proceeded without incident. The government refused to recognize them, so we sued them. And we asked our case to be joined with the eight cases, the eight couples, to become one case, which happened. And we won the court case. We won the appeal case. We ultimately won the free vote in Parliament. And when we won the appeal case, the appeal judges ordered the province to backdate the approval to include our weddings. So that's what made the weddings on January the 14th, 2001, the first legal ones.
Mm.
And we see it spreading around the world, you know, province by province, state by state, country by country, you know. And that next morning, every newspaper had exactly the same picture, me standing in between the two couples at the end of the at the end of the wedding. And it appeared in a number of newspapers around the world. And I heard from various activists that it was the first time in some newspapers there ever was a mm-hmm. positive portrayal of anything to do with gay or lesbian issues. Mm-hmm. And it was about love, and it was about church, and all the symbolism was really powerful. And I thought it was a powerful example of what my ministry is about, because, you know, I'm partly, you know, spiritual leader when mm-hmm. you're a pastor, but you're also, you know, a social justice activist, you know, because it's about, you know, faith and works. And so I thought that really symbolized the best of the Christian church, being a safe place mm-hmm. for spirituality, but also being a strong voice for justice, in the same way that Martin Luther King was. You know, and the same way Tommy Douglas was in Canada. I mean, we have socialized medicine because of a Baptist minister who was concerned about people and wanted fairness and equality.
Hmm. Wow. So in the years since the first ever legal same-sex marriage in the world, you officiated, what are you most proud of, sort of in terms of the role in the years since until you retired a couple of years ago? Well, yeah, what? You know, what do you look back on and feel proud of your church, proud of your community, and how they've shown up for justice?
Yeah. I think I would say two things. I think in terms of the church as an institution, I'm really proud of the way the church not only created a safe place for people to worship, but also played a leadership role for justice, and that changed the attitudes in the broader LGB community to be able to reaffirm spirituality, reaffirm religion, et cetera. So I'm really proud of that movement that the church was an important part of. But I'm also really proud of so many individuals who are so brave. You know, people in those early days who would come out at work and ask for benefits for their partner when it wasn't popular and when it wasn't legally required. Or people who came out to their families or friends or stood up for the individual allies, for parents who stood up for their gay son or lesbian daughter, that, you know, lots of individuals. You know, I've gotten quite a few accolades down through the years as kind of the figurehead of some of this, but it took their bravery to really change things. And so, you know, yeah, people can point to institutions or individuals who've done some, you know, some leadership things, but it took all of those individual brave acts, and I'm really proud of that. And mm-hmm. and their names will never be known, you know, mm-hmm. the risks they took, the people who ended up being fired when they did that or stood up for someone, and their names may never be known. Mm-hmm. But it's not the recognition, it's the contribution that's important. And they know, you know, they know what they've done and the role that they played, individuals who donated money to causes or put placards together for demonstrations or provided security on demonstrations. You know, all of those individual acts really inspire me.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So we're going to pause the conversation here, and we will be rejoined by you in our next episode to talk about what's next. So you've retired from the Metropolitan Community Church. And so we're going to get into, you know, why you decided to retire and what are sort of the issues that you are considering as you launch this Faith in Crisis Week, as you sort of lead Rainbow Faith and Freedom to look towards Canada, to look towards the world. Because as you mentioned, there is still much, much work to be done. So thank you so much for joining us today, Brent.
Thank you.
So thank you for listening today. I really hope you enjoyed it. And please stay tuned as we gear towards our resource launch week, Faith in Crisis, coming up November 24th to the 29th, all happening virtually, of course. We will be hosting live performances, panels, a film screening, and more podcasts. And I will be interviewing Susan Gapka, a legendary trans rights activist, and many others, and speaking about decolonizing gender, repatriating spirituality in an Indigenous context, and so much more. If you want to hear more, please subscribe on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and like us on Facebook for all the details. This has been Queer Devotions.